Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn. Coming up, 14 of the schoolgirls abducted in northeastern Nigeria have been reunited with their parents. But the threat to education in the region is still perceived by this teacher as being very real.
If necessary action should not be taken against this attack, knowledge in the northeast or in the northern Nigeria will be a serious problem.
And the cost of sending money home. We talked to a British NGO that claims that Africans in the diaspora are effectively paying a super tax on their remittances.
This is a region that is currently losing, on our estimate, about $1.8 billion annually. You've got the world's poorest region paying the highest remittance charges.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Suspected Islamist militants have struck for a fourth time in 3 days in Nigeria. Following a bomb attack in Abuja and the abduction of 100 schoolgirls, gunmen marched into the palace of a district monarch in Saban Kosowa and shot him along with his security guard. 18 other people in the village of Wala were also killed by gunmen on Wednesday. Al-Mahin Muhammad is a journalist in Gombe State in northeastern Nigeria. I asked him what was now known about the abduction of the schoolgirls.
Up to now, there is little information about their whereabouts, only that the Borno State governor conducted an interview with the press in Maiduguri. He said that 14 out of those girls were found, and the governor promised to give amount of 50 million naira to anybody who gave useful information that can lead to the discovery of those girls.
You say 14 girls were found. Have they been reunited with their parents?
Yes, they have reunited with their parents, but they are in a horrible and terrible situation.
Schools are being shut down across the three states hit by the insurgency. How are parents and school children reacting to this?
Yes, it is true that schools were closed in some parts of northeast. For example, Gombe State governor has directed all secondary schools to be closed 3 weeks earlier than the schedule did for the end of the second term. People are expressing concern and worried about their children's future as far as education is concerned, because they don't know where to take their children to. Wherever they took the children cannot be safe unless if it is out of the country, because Boko Haram threatened to attack any school that exists in this part of the country. I talked to a teacher and asked him how did he feel about what is happening in this part of the country. This is what the teacher is saying.
My name is Alhaji Bapa Haruna Gwambi. Of course, since the happening of the attack in the Bunyadi, teachers and the parents are really in fear. They are seriously disturbed because the only place where their children will be kept with the security and everything to learn and to produce a very good people future in our Nigeria, they are now facing problem. They are now being attacked. Some they will be killed, some they will be taken away to somewhere unknown. But our fear later, I don't think if any parents can send their children to this school because of that attack. So we are calling the attention of the federal government. If necessary action should not be taken against this attack, knowledge in the northeast or in the northern Nigeria will be a serious problem.
Now, Boko Haram is opposed to Western education and schools are being closed down, as we've been hearing. Do people in Nigeria feel that Boko Haram is winning the insurgency?
Yes, people in this part of country believe that Boko Haram is winning this war because they go to any place they want and attack. They can even send a letter to the place that we are coming to this place and attack, and they will definitely go there. This indicates that they are really winning the war because the military cannot stop them from going to any place to attack. There is heavy military presence in Borno, Yobe, and Adamawa, but despite this heavy presence of security personnel, these people are attacking anywhere they want. And Sambisa is in Borno State. You can imagine the soldiers are there, but they cannot go to the place where the Boko Haram are because they don't have enough equipment to attack the Boko Haram. The Boko Haram gets more weapons than that of Nigerian army. Even the Borno State governor recently said that. What is happening is because the military is lacking enough equipment to fight Boko Haram. That's why the problem still persists.
Al-Amin Mohammed. Boko Haram has been waging an insurgency against Nigeria and its institutions since 2009. A crackdown on the militant Islamist sect by the security forces has so far only met with limited success, as we've just been hearing. But who are Boko Haram and what do they want? Let's listen now to this Africa Link Fact Box with Stephen Mpuku and Abubakar Jalou.
The Islamist militant group Boko Haram, meaning Western education is sinful, was founded by Muhammad Yusuf. Since then, Boko Haram has carried out frequent attacks on schools in Nigeria's northeastern states of Borno, Maiduguri, and Yobe. Its followers are influenced by the Quranic phrase translated as "Anyone who is not governed by what Allah has revealed is among the transgressors."
Boko Haram promotes a version of Islam which forbids Muslims from taking part in any political and social activities associated with Western society. This includes voting in elections, wearing shirts and trousers, or receiving a secular education.
Boko Haram carried out a spate of violent attacks on police stations and government buildings in Maiduguri. This led to shootouts on the streets of Maiduguri, forcing residents to flee. Boko Haram fighters suffered heavy casualties.
Nigeria's security forces eventually seized the group's headquarters in Maiduguri, capturing some of its fighters and killing its founder, Muhammad Yusuf. His body was shown on state television, and the security forces declared Boko Haram finished.
But its fighters regrouped under a new leader, Abubakar Shekau, and in 2010, they attacked a prison in Bauchi State, freeing hundreds of the group's supporters. The sect is notorious for using gunmen on motorbikes that attack and kill police officers, politicians, and anyone who criticizes its activities, including other Muslim clerics and a Christian preacher.
Boko Haram has staged several audacious attacks in different parts of northeastern Nigeria, showing that it is establishing a presence across the region and fueling tension between Muslims and Christians. These include the 2011 Christian Day bombings in Abuja and Damaturu, a 2010 New Year's Eve attack on a military barracks in Abuja, several explosions around the inauguration of President Goodluck Jonathan in 2011, and the bombings of the police and United Nations headquarters in Abuja.
The attacks have raised global concern, with a U.S. congressional report released in November 2011 warning that Boko Haram was an emerging threat to the U.S. and its interests. The report said Boko Haram may be forging ties with Al-Qaeda-linked groups in Africa, but the group denies this accusation.
This year, the group's fighters have killed more than 1,500 civilians in three states in northeastern Nigeria, which are currently under emergency rule. Analysts say the threat will disappear only if the Nigerian government manages to reduce the region's chronic poverty and builds an educational system which gains the support of local Muslims.
Abubakar Jalou and Stephen Mpuku.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
In South Sudan, rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar have seized the capital of Unity State, Bentiu, and have warned oil firms operating there to pack up and leave within a week. The conflict between the rebels and the forces of President Salva Kiir has already disrupted oil production, upon which the government depends for most of its revenue. Elke Gravert is a senior researcher at the Bonn International Center for Conversion, an independent German think tank. I asked her if the fall of Bentiu would be a big setback for the government.
Yeah, maybe have to go back a little bit in the origin of this conflict. It is a power conflict between the president Salva Kiir and the former vice president Riek Machar. And we are now in the situation that within one party, they have a power struggle about the presidency now. And if now this rebel force captures oil fields, the main resource of South Sudan, it is just heightening this power struggle. I believe because even in Upper Nile State, where the capital is Malakal, they have been taking the capital and then the South Sudan army, the SPLA, has recaptured it and the rebels have taken it again. This might happen again also in Unity State with Bantu. So it is not now settled that forever it will be under control of the rebels. But the crucial point is, how do they get out of the armed confrontation where this power struggle has ended now?
The rebels are ordering the oil firms to leave. Why are they doing this? Who is going to pump the oil out of the ground once they've gone?
I think it can only be understood as the oil companies will not be able to continue production in such a state of insecurity. Before, it was the SPLA, the South Sudanese army, which protected the oil field together with some forces of the intelligence of the South Sudanese government. Now it will be unclear who protects them. They already evacuated a lot of staff. They already reduced oil production. And I think if the rebels claim to chase them out, I think it's also in the interest of the oil companies to leave for the time being, because nothing is secure. They are at risk and in danger. So I think it is difficult that just the rebels take over and the companies continue producing as they used to do before. I don't think that this is very realistic.
If the rebels control the oil fields in South Sudan, does that mean that the government has lost this conflict?
If this remains stable, this control of oil fields, this will force the government more into finding a solution. It can be still a military solution. And as far as I can see, civil war is still the main option on both sides, on the government as well as on the side of Riek Machar's White Army. So the risk is now that we have a scenario where the civil war is starting again or continuing for some time, unless they are forced to negotiate politically. What I was thinking is, during the earlier civil war in South Sudan, South Sudan, of course, did not have any oil resources and still had a very long civil war for 22 years. So I think the worst case scenario could be that they have to go back to the same way of fighting without oil resources, where they just depended on looting, maybe on support from outside, on all the arms which are already in the country, and on aid, of course, diverting aid for their purposes. That was the situation during the earlier civil war.
Elke Gravert from the Bonn International Center for Conversion.
Behind the headlines.
Mozambique has been at peace for the last 21 years, but that peace is now looking fragile. Tensions spiked in October when the RENAMO opposition party cancelled a peace agreement with its former civil war foe, FRELIMO, now the governing party. There have been reports of sporadic acts of violence. Earlier this month, FRELIMO accused RENAMO of attacking a coal train on the Sena railway line, a charge which RENAMO denies. It's a conflict which continues to simmer behind the headlines, as we hear in this report, written by Christiana Vieira and presented by Susan Holton.
The origin of the present conflict between Mozambique's ruling party FRELIMO and its former civil war foe, now the largest opposition party, RENAMO, is a row over the composition of the National Electoral Commission. Renamo accused Frelimo of dominating the electoral institutions and demanded equal representation. Even more than 20 years after the end of the civil war, Renamo's fighters have never been disarmed, and the party has kept a number of its military bases, for example in the Gorongosa region in the centre of the country. In April last year, when the negotiation process was at a standstill, violence flared up. At the same time, the parties continued to meet in the capital Maputo, in a total of 24 inconclusive rounds of talks. 6 months later, in October, government troops seized Renamo's base in the Gorongosa region. Renamo reacted by annulling the Rome General Peace Accords of 1992. Renamo spokesman Fernando Mazanga made this statement at the time.
The attack against Renamo's president Afonso Dhlakama's base is a declaration of war, because the army is being used. This means the army is making war against Renamo's president.
Dialogue was then suspended and the fighting intensified, especially in central Mozambique. It was not until January this year that the parties agreed to go back to the negotiating table. Political analyst Pedro Niaseche sums up the situation.
While politicians tried to score points in the negotiations, the armed conflict continued.
After Parliament approved two electoral law drafts proposed by Renamo in February of this year, the atmosphere improved considerably. However, there were still armed clashes. Early this month, Deputy Interior Minister Jose Mandra blamed Renamo for an attack on a convoy of the major coal producer in the country, the Brazilian company Vale, in central Mozambique.
Renamo shot this convoy which was bringing coal, and the driver was hit in the foot.
Renamo denied responsibility. One day before, the two parties had agreed to set up a central command to observe and monitor a ceasefire with equal participation of both, and under the chairmanship of Botswana. Neighbouring South Africa also participates. Political analyst Fernando Lima points out that three of Renamo's demands have still not been met: the integration of its members into the government's security forces, that ties between state institutions and Frelimo should be loosened, and that the country's wealth should be shared.
It seems to me that from the government side, and through the media connected to it, there has been an attempt to convey the idea that there would be a ceasefire as soon as the election package was agreed. Well, there is no formal agreement to that end.
According to the government, the clashes in the Gorongosa region have resulted in the displacement of nearly 7,000 people. Dozens were killed and injured in the fighting. Presidential elections are due in October. It is unclear whether peace will have returned to the country by then.
That report was written by Christiana Vieira. When Africans living in the diaspora send money back home, they have to dig deep into their pockets. This is because of the high charges they have to pay just to get the money from one place to another. Those charges can be around 12%. That's $12 for every $100 sent. The Overseas Development Institute is a UK-based NGO, and it has just issued a report claiming that Africans in the diaspora are essentially paying a remittance super tax. Kevin Watkins is one of the co-authors of the document, which says that Africans pay almost double the global average when sending money back home. I asked him what the reason for this was.
It's for a number of reasons. It's, first of all, this is not a particularly competitive market. We have two major global players, MoneyGram and Western Union, who between them account for something like two-thirds of all payment outlets for remittances in Africa. When you have that degree of restricted competition, it's never good for getting prices down. Secondly, it's a sector that's characterized by what we describe as some restricted business practices involving banks in Africa, money transfer operators, and agents who work for money transfer operators. Without going into technical details, these are essentially exclusivity agreements that stipulate that once a bank is working with one company, it won't work with any of its competitors. That restricts market entry. And the third factor that we highlight is really just the lack of transparency in the market. A big chunk of the charges that are incurred by Africa's diaspora come through foreign currency conversion fees. For some countries, that can be up to half of the total costs. And yet it's very difficult to get information on the website of the remittance agencies which indicates in a clear fashion what those fees are.
Are you accusing the money transfer operators, Western Union and MoneyGram, of making excessive profits?
What we're saying is that Africa gets a very bad deal out of the global remittance market. You know, this is a region that is currently losing, on our estimate, about $1.8 billion annually. You've got the world's poorest region paying the highest remittance charges. And at a time when we're seeing breakthroughs in mobile technology, in e-commerce, remittance charges for Africa are actually going up slightly instead of coming down as they are in the rest of the world. Now, that is just unacceptable. The 1.8 billion that I mentioned, that's just a financial number, but it's equivalent to the cost of getting 14 million kids into school, providing clean water for 21 million people, expanding access to sanitation. So, you know, there are real human and economic costs associated with this system that just isn't working.
Do Africans abroad have any other options when sending money home quickly?
It depends on the country. You know, if you take a country like Somalia, where the big money transfer operators don't operate, there is an informal system called the Hawala system, which also operates across other parts of Africa. In the case of Somalia, where it's a very widespread system, you actually have much lower charges, surprisingly, than you do in countries like Kenya and Tanzania. So that's an example of, you know, competition driving the prices down.
You're calling on the money transfer operators to cut their charges, but that would mean less profit for them, wouldn't it?
Well, that depends on how efficient they are. If you cut charges, other things being equal, you would expect demand for their services to go up. So they could secure comparable profits from an expanded volume while imposing lower charges on Africans. That's how efficient markets operate. This isn't an efficient market.
What does Africa need to do to help bring these charges down?
We've called on African governments to review very closely these exclusive agreements that operate between money transfer operators and agents in Africa and commercial banks in Africa. Some governments are already taking steps to revoke those agreements. One example is the Central Bank of Nigeria. Tunisia has done exactly the same thing. The Competition Commission in Gambia has accused the money transfer industry of engaging in restrictive business practices and is introducing reforms.
Kevin Watkins from the Overseas Development Institute.
Opinion.
And let's return to our top story. The mass abduction of schoolgirls aged between 15 and 18 has shocked Nigeria and showed how the Boko Haram insurgency has brought lawlessness to swathes of the country's northeast, claiming hundreds of lives in recent months. Why do you think the Nigerian authorities are unable to stop the insurgency? That question once again, why are the Nigerian authorities unable to stop the insurgency? Let us know what you think in a text message to country code 49 160 957 595 10 or in an email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. And before we say goodbye, a reminder of our main stories. Suspected Islamist militants have struck for a fourth time in 3 days in Nigeria, killing 20 people, including a traditional ruler, in attacks in the country's northeast. South Sudan's army has admitted that rebels loyal to ex-Vice President Riek Machar have seized control of the key oil town of Bentiu. We've also been talking to an NGO about the high costs Africans living abroad incur when they send money back home. More stories from Africa at the same time tomorrow. As always, thank you for listening. From me, Mark Caldwell. Bye now.